Just don't mention your name if you're worried. Okay, I'm fine.
Okay.
Okay.
Well,
all right.
Welcome back to the third session of our workshop this morning. We have a slightly smaller session with three speakers, so we can probably absorb the delay we've made now later into this session, or maybe a little bit into lunchtime. We won't end late today. At least I don't think that will happen. We have three speakers this morning, so let me announce first to you Steve Fuller. We're very happy to have him. Steve is a native of New York City, but more importantly, he's Auguste Comte Professor of Social Epistemology at University of Warwick in Britain. Steve was trained at Columbia, at Cambridge, and in Pittsburgh, where in the latter two he did degrees in history and philosophy of science. He's really best known for his work on social epistemology. Did you actually coin the term, Steve? Is that yours? Or?
I didn't coin it, but I'm the one who kind of made it as it is.
Right.
A bit like psychoanalysis, actually. And you can draw whatever conclusions you want from that.
Well, Steve has published widely on that, on philosophy, science, on also sociology of intellectual life, on the future of humanity, and on Kuhn and Popper, and that's why we have him here today. He's the author of 22 books, translated as at least as many languages, of which I will mention two, because I have happened to have read them. Thomas Kuhn, A Philosophical History of Our Times, which came out in 2000 with the University of Chicago Press, and a little bit more recently, Kuhn versus Popper, The Struggle for the Soul of Science, that came out in 2003. He's received many awards, has been also, next to his university work, being an advisor and member of several think tanks and non-profits. And he's here with us today to give a talk, the only talk in our workshop, I think, that has a normative title.
Oh. And I thought all this other stuff was normative.
Well, I guess we hide it. Yeah. Namely, the fate of the idea of the open society in the 20th century. Should Popper have been trying to save it from its friends rather than its enemies? Steve.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. You don't need to clap before I speak. You want to actually listen to what I say before. Let me just start by saying it's a real honor to be back here. I was the salutatorian of the class of 1979 at Columbia College, okay? Which meant that as far as the graduation ceremonies, I introduced things, and it's great to be introducing this conference today. However, what I want to say is that when we think, so the idea of talking about the open society was something that was assigned to me by the organizers of the conference, okay? It's not necessarily the topic I would have chosen myself, but it was a topic that, in a sense, I responded to once it was proposed. And so there is an issue here, it seems to me, about liberalism, okay? So liberalism is what I'm going to talk about, and what exactly that means. Now, when I was a student here, 40 years ago, when I was starting out, there were two books that I read that were very influential in my thinking subsequently, and they were part of a kind of general, you know, as you know, any of you who are actually part of Columbia University will know that there are these kinds of courses that you're required to take, and you have a different sort of set of opportunities, a kind of a menu, in a sense, of what you can take from them. And this is before you actually major in a particular subject. So I majored in history and sociology only because it had the least requirements. So it allowed me greatest leverage. And it was on that basis that I actually graduated number two in my class in 1979. Now, in the first year, two books that I read, one of them was Karl Polanyi's The Great Transformation. So this is 1976, okay? And I know this is a kind of book that gets kicked around and think, you know, people keep on thinking this is the next thing, right? It's been the next thing for 40 years. You've got to think about whether this book really is so significant, or at least in terms of what we think about the future. So I'm going to be very explicit here. I'm talking normative, right? And so while the great transformation of Karl Polanyi is a very important work with regard to thinking about the problems of capitalism and stuff like that, it's been talked about for 40 years, and it keeps on getting sort of replayed in different ways. And frankly, I actually don't think it's that interesting. What's more interesting is what's happened to Joseph Schumpeter's work, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, which is another work which I was asked to read at Columbia in 1976. Both of these works, by the way, I should say, came out in 1942-43 originally. And so we're reading these in the first year as part of this kind of what you might call general education sort of thing. And see, back then, I don't know if any of you, have any of you read Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy? A few of you had, right. Right, and this is amazing, right? These are historians. You know, you guys should know stuff, right? Imagine the rest of the world. And the thing is that this book back then, in 1976, was understood as basically predicting what was going to happen with regard to the future of capitalism. Okay, this is kind of why we read it, right? 1976, right? So Schumpeter's thesis in that book, which was his, which what most people regard as his major book, was about how capitalism's boom and bust cycles, which was spawned by this kind of entrepreneurial innovation stuff, right, which was really important in getting the Industrial Revolution going and getting capitalism going over the course of the 19th and early 20th century, would after a while be seen as so disruptive that we would need the state to come in to kind of mitigate or stop this in some substantial fashion. And so Schumpeter was predicting in 1942-43 that this would be socialism, a kind of socialism, right? A kind of middle way socialism. And you see, this is the kind of stuff that Columbia was promoting back in the mid-70s, right? The middle way, right? That at the end of the day, you know, this is where Karl Polanyi and Joseph Schumpeter look like fellow travelers, right? Because they're promoting a kind of middle way in coming from different directions. But this was what Schumpeter was known for, right? Schumpeter was known for this guy who is predicting that at the end of the day we'd have some kind of social democracy, some kind of controlled market socialism maybe. I mean, something along those lines, just because capitalism, given its entrepreneurial nature, right? So the entrepreneurial nature is part of what makes capitalism what it is, would be disrupted, you know, so much, cause so much harm that the state would actually be seen by everyone, including even the capitalists, as having a purpose. That was the view, okay? That was the view when I was a kid, right? When 17 years old, when I was at Columbia University, that was the view, right? So even if you didn't buy Keynes, right? So even if you didn't buy the Keynesian welfare state and you didn't buy the kind of human rights tinged arguments, Rawls, all this bullshit that was also around the 70s, right, Schumpeter, in a sense, was the clear-headed guy who told you that at the end of the day that the state would have to intervene, okay? Well, that didn't quite happen in a way, right? It didn't really quite happen. And in fact, the interesting thing, of course, is people are reading Schumpeter today, but they're reading him for different reasons, right? Because they're reading him as the guy who actually came up with the idea that capitalism was pushed forward because of entrepreneurial innovation, blah, 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 right? That's why Schumpeter is such a big deal now. And he, you know, I mean, and this is kind of interesting from someone who actually has lived. And some of you have lived as well. But for those of you who've lived through this transition, here's a guy who's, in a sense, his reputation has remained kind of intact in terms of his significance with regard to the history of economics, or however you want to call it. But nevertheless, the nature, the character of his influence, the character of his being has changed substantially as the time has changed. And I think this is kind of the world we live in now, where Schumpeter, yes, is in a sense a justifying figure, but he's a justifying figure in a way that's different from, let's say, Karl Polanyi, right? Who, in a sense, Karl Polanyi remains as this kind of lost future kind of guy. Okay, that's how I read him. I mean, some of you may have a lot to say about him in a very positive way, but he's basically the lost future, okay? Boris Schumpeter is someone who has kind of, in a sense, because of the kind of thing he's saying, has been able to be reinterpreted in rather interesting ways that makes him continuously relevant. So for those of you who are primarily historians, that's an interesting issue there, right? That Schumpeter, as a personality, that he's someone who, in a sense, continues to be relevant, but for what I would say are radically different reasons from when I was a student. Where someone like Polanyi, he's kind of lost past, right? He's that's how he continues, okay? And so both of these figures were introduced in the liberal arts curriculum at this university in 1976. Okay, so now the Open Society. Now the Open Society, we associate this book with Karl Popper. Karl Popper wrote this book while he was in exile in New Zealand. So you know Karl Popper. I'm assuming everyone who would be at a conference like this would know who he is. I would say he's the most interesting philosopher of science of the 20th century in the sense of what he emphasizes about what's important about science from a normative standpoint, namely the falsifiability idea. I think that's, in fact, a very bold and daring thing to put in the forefront, okay, given the fact that over the course of the 20th century, science becomes this kind of foundation of the establishment of modern society, that here's Popper coming along and saying, quite unlike Kuhn, for example, that in fact what makes science what it is as science is that it is always breaking away from tradition, at least trying to falsify hypotheses. Okay? This is very different from Kuhn, right? I mean, I think the picture that you get from Kuhn with regard to the way the history of science relates to the history of society is one where Kuhn believes in something like, and I think Conant may have something to do with this actually, a linear model. Namely, in other words, science needs to remain, in a sense, autonomous. That is to say, it needs to work out its own issues. And then once it works out its own issues, then, in a sense, it can be presented to society as perhaps some basis for governance. Okay? So there's a sense in which the scientists sort out their problems, and then you can apply them to social problems if, in fact, the scientists have sorted out their problems. So there's a linear process taking place. It's not a matter of that the public ought to be actually investigating or looking into what the professional scientists are arguing about at the moment, because that would actually confuse the situation. That I take to be kind of Kuhn's basically default standpoint, and it's one that I think he gets from Conant, because even though, the one sense in which I would say that Conant is a technocrat is that Conant believes, in a sense, that at the end of the day, science will dictate how society goes, but it will dictate how society goes only in its own time, right? So in other words, if science hasn't sorted out something yet, then there is nothing to actually apply to society. And so society shouldn't be knocking on the door all the time, right? This is the point, and this is where, you know, Conant's kind of view, and I think Robert Merton had this kind of view too, if you look at the norms of science that Robert Merton was promoting, had about science as a, quote, open society. It was an open society in the small, right? In other words, it's open with regard to the scientific community, but what it's not open to is the larger society in which the science is embedded. So there is a clear sense of a linear, hierarchical, whatever you want to call it, kind of structure going on in that kind of thinking, okay? So there's a clear sense of what the difference is between the scientific community and something outside the scientific community, okay? Popper actually doesn't have this. This is the point that I would like to make to you, that Popper actually doesn't have this kind of idea. Popper doesn't have any evidence of a professional notion of science, of the kind of paradigm bullshit that Kuhn has, where you can't actually get into science unless you've been trained in a certain way, right? If you, you know, this is the way in which Kuhn is very similar to Michael Polanyi, right, where in a sense the key sociological moment for becoming a scientist is getting trained as a scientist and learning. Popper doesn't have this. He doesn't have any of this bullshit. He's like a logical positivist in that respect, right? I mean, remember, you got to remember what logical positivism was about and why it was considered as a radical movement and a universalist movement at the time it was proposed. Because the idea was, you want to cut through the bullshit of the metaphysics, of the all the competing jargons. And what was the problem with all this metaphysics and competing jargons? Because they were trying to establish bases for authority that were limited in some way, right? In other words, if you want to know the truth, you've got to do it my way, right? It was an argument against path dependency, as economists would normally think about it. That was what logical positivism and Popper share in common, is an argument against path dependency. Okay? So path dependency is something that we're familiar with from the history of technology. Okay? So path dependency is about the idea that there are all these different people trying to figure out how to do things, and then one of them gets into place and they lock out everybody else. Right? That's kind of the, and that's path dependency, and then everyone, if they want to succeed, have to go down that path. Right? Brian Arthur, if you know nothing, you know, if you want to follow this out in the economics literature, right? Brian Arthur, a guy who I think actually deserves a Nobel Prize. He's at the Santa Fe Institute. He used to be at the University of Michigan. Right? Brian Arthur, right? The guy who's very much behind path dependency. Okay? This is the kind of thing that people like the logical positivists and Popper were against. Right, this idea that in some sense, once the first person hit on something, in some sense have some kind of hereditary entitlement to it, right? And hereditary entitlement to it, because remember, heredity prior to the 20th century did not necessarily mean biological heredity, but of course it meant, you know, the transmission of property on the economic legal level, right? You all know this. Right? So this is the kind of thing that, in a sense, Popper, as a liberal, was against. Was against this kind of thing. So in other words, what he was against was the idea of turning the scientific mode of being, which was becoming increasingly implicated into the way in which social structures were being reproduced in the 20th century, into something that was comparable, an analog, to what hereditary dynasties had been, okay, over the course of previous human history, right? So instead of, as it were, transmitting your genes, the idea of transmitting your ideas, so in other words, the only way in which anyone could take you seriously is if you went to the right university, right? In the past, that would have been, if anyone takes you seriously, it is because you came from the right gene pool. Okay, this is the thing that Popper was concerned about and the logical positivists were concerned about, I would say, from the standpoint of what is relevant now with regard to how we think about where these kinds of ideas come from and what, you know, what exactly does the future of liberalism, because liberalism is kind of the term that is thrown in there to kind of capture this sensibility, right? So this is what I would like to defend as liberalism. How much time do I have? Because I see you're looking at your watch.
You have some 7 more minutes.
7 more minutes, okay. Because I want to bring some questions into this. So liberalism, if we're thinking about liberalism today, okay, this is the kind of issue that I think we should think about, namely breaking path dependency and how exactly that happens. Okay, and there's I would say that the university becomes a very contested site for this kind of activity, because there is a sense in which one might think about a university as a place where one kind of institutionalized reproduction process is replaced by another type of institutionalized reproduction process, right? So instead of having come from the right gene pool. Now it matters whether you come from the right university, right? So there's a sense in which it's not surprising that in a sense, people who want to claim the mantle of liberalism now, you know, and the open society and so forth, are talking about the university as the site. But the point that I would raise here is exactly what it is about the past that one would want to make available to the future, okay, that is not does not necessarily know, does not necessarily involve knowing everything about how the past got to be the way it is. And I think for historians, this is kind of a tricky issue, because in a sense, you guys, you earn your living by knowing everything that happened before things got to be the way they are now. But in a sense, what really is important from a normative standpoint is the sort of things from the past that need to be taken forward in the future to people who don't know anything about what happened in the past. Okay? This is the issue. In other words, you got to make knowledge less path dependent, right? And I think that in a sense, Humboldt, you know, the founder of the kind of modern university ideal, who presented himself as a liberal in the late 18th century, and of course was the rector of the University of Berlin in the early 19th century, he understood this idea, I thought, pretty well. And this was something that was in fact recognized at the time and subsequently. And that there's an issue about freedom to teach, which we often talk about as academic freedom, but there's also freedom to learn, okay? And so the question I'm talking about with regard to liberalism and the possibility of an open society is the conditions under which people who are not yet steeped in everything that's happened in the past are able actually to go forward. Because the question is, do you just need to reproduce the past in your being? I hope the answer is no, right? Because otherwise, what you just got there is a less efficient way of doing what genetics was already doing, right? What you want is some kind of different sort of sensibility. And this is where teaching matters, okay? So we think about the Humboldtian university in terms of the unity of research and teaching. And of course, research is always about pushing forward the boundaries of knowledge and all that kind of stuff, and we're cool on that. But then the question becomes, what are the demands on teaching, right, in a liberal society? And is the demands on teaching in a liberal society simply to reproduce the past? That seems to me to undermine the whole idea, right? Because it basically turns what one might imagine to be a public good into a club good, as economists say. Where, in a sense, the value of the good is accrued simply by virtue of having gone through a rather elite, limited way of getting there, right? That's a club good, right? So the entry costs are very high, as the economists would say. Okay, so the point is that the Humboldtian University was about providing the freedom to learn, and that's something that academics need to do by showing in their classroom practice that, in fact, it is not necessary to have gone through what I went through or any other teacher went through in order to reach the conclusions that I did, right? And also to show that there are also openness, right? That there are things that we haven't figured out yet. So in other words, you shouldn't take what I'm saying as a truth, but there are a lot of things that need to be sorted out, et cetera, et cetera. And that it's up to you to do that, and if you're really doing your job as an academic in the future, you should be overturning what I'm saying now, right? This is just Max Weber, Science as a Vocation, okay? I'm just giving you a kind of vulgarized version of what Max Weber, Science as a Vocation, was saying back 100 years ago, okay? And that is the open society, right? The open society turns out to be that kind of thing. And I think Popper, what he was trying to do was trying to lay out in a very, relatively, not exclusively or even in a great way, technical way, kind of what it means actually to sort of nail down what I'm talking about here, right? So falsifiability, right? So in other words, there's a sense in which, So Popper puts a big deal on falsifiability, the falsifiability of hypothesis. What this ends up boiling down to is the idea of the person who's proposing a hypothesis actually coming up with the conditions under which it might be shown to be false. It's not to say that they will be false, that they are false, but to actually talk about the things that you might want to look at. And what's the value of showing that something is false under those circumstances? It provides a kind of invitation for others to actually enter into the inquiry that otherwise would not be there, right? Because the only invitation to enter into the inquiry are from those who already share the mindset of the people of the dominant worldview, right? Of the dominant point of view. Okay? And this is what I would take Popper's open society thing to be about. And when you go back to where Popper is starting from with regard to people like Plato and so forth, right? Plato's big beef is with the dramatists, right? Why are the dramatists a problem in Plato's Republic? Because they propose an alternative way of thinking about how the world might be. Okay? And they're doing this in a very dramatic way. It seems very vivid. It seems like something that perhaps we could do ourselves if we were given a chance. And so, in other words, once people see this going on the stage, they might think, hey, this is a basis for changing things. Whereas what Plato really wanted was something more like what Aristotle provided, whereby when you see something on a stage that provides an alternative basis for reality, you have a kind of natural closure, right? So you have a happy ending, you have something like that, you have catharsis, you have something like that. Where in a sense, you don't feel like once you see the alternative, you need to go out there and do something, okay? And so if you look at the history of the way in which theater has figured into, you know, politics, you will see that very often theater has been very controversial because what they're doing on the stage is a kind of alternative version of reality that looks not so different. So in other words, we could be doing something rather different starting from the same premises of the people who are who exist now. We don't have to go in the same direction. And we don't have to think about what's going on the stage as a fiction. We can just think of it as an alternative reality we can move into. And I would point out, and I'll conclude here, that the open society is about that, right? The open society is about the idea that the past underdetermines the future, right? So that when you see plays, when you see other ways of being, they are in fact drawing on the past. It's not denying the past, but it's moving it in a different direction. And that is the thing that, to a large extent, I would say that liberalism constantly needs to be upholding in whatever political regime it finds itself in. And I'll stop there. You all convinced? Yeah. Yeah, George. And then we'll move to Rainey.
I'm just struck by some of that.
Speak up a little bit.
This idea of path dependency, and you're urging us to overcome it. And I think in a lot of ways, this is what Conant was actually trying to do. And I'm not sure if I'm objecting to you on that point or not. But the idea is that's what general education is about.
Yes.
So what struck me, we're talking about how someone comes up with an idea and then we're stuck with that. And that's the situation we want to kind of avoid. And I just recently realized, reading the book that Andy was talking about yesterday, in the preface, any kind of enigmatic remark about our political system, which is chaotic and haphazard and can deliver up surprises. And I never really understood what that meant until Trump was elected.
Right.
And then I realized for Conant, I think he's talking about Harry Truman, about which there was a lot of anxiety, because suddenly this hat salesman from Iowa, very close
Missouri. Missouri, man. Independence, Missouri, right? That was the thing with him.
And Conant was, you know, first in line to worry about the future of atomic weapons. So that's why... So this is the difference. Conant accepts that we are going to have not a, a fully open society, but we can, through education, create this mechanism that tends to subvert the path dependence by, in his ideal world, ensuring that every person who comes to power, that the political system grants a lot of power, is informed by the ideals of liberalism, which eschew final truths and accept the importance of, you know, open-ended scientific
research,
criticism, and liberalism, and so forth. And just to put a note on it, he was, by the way, you were talking about inheritance. Conant was against the inheritance tax at one point. I mean, against
the idea of inheritance.
The very idea, the very idea of inherited wealth he proposed should be taken away in America.
Great. No.
I don't think he stuck to it because he would have probably.
He wouldn't have benefited.
But he published it. He published this idea in 43.
No. Look. For those of you who follow what I've said about Kuhn and Conant and all this kind of stuff, my beef isn't actually against Conant, it's against Kuhn. So there's a sense in which I'm willing to grant all this stuff you say about Conant. The problem with Kuhn, as a kind of, you might say, a beneficiary of the Conant largesse intellectually, is that he never really got into any of this kind of stuff, okay? But I'm willing to grant this point, and it is very much on my wavelength about eliminating, you know, inheritance and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. So I'm agreeing with you. Yes, Lorraine.
This is a question about.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Sure. This is a question about an element of logical positivism, at least Carnap's version of logical positivism, and I'd be curious to know what Popper thought about it.
Mm.
And it's an element which is very self-consciously path-dependent in your sense of investing in the past. In Der Logische Aufbau der Welt, Carnap says what he wants to do to accomplish for philosophy is, just as you say, to jettison metaphysics and the dead weight of the past, but he wants to make philosophy like science,
mm-hmm.
in that it will be a collective and progressive enterprise in which one stone will be laid upon another in the manner, I think his analogy is to medieval cathedrals, of a collective enterprise
the
that
Aufbau.
Grows with time. And that, of course, depends very much on a tradition which is a progressive tradition, and also it is a collective tradition, unlike other precepts of liberalism. It does not enshrine the individual. On the contrary, Carnap thinks that anonymity should be the condition for these contributions.
No. But you're raising a good, that's a good point. No, and I think that gets to the kind of the difference in the spirit between which Carnap and Popper were operating, okay? Because obviously, you know, when we do history, right, there's a sense in which people end up in the same place for quite different reasons, right? And I think we need to take that seriously with regard to Carnap and Popper, okay? And here I would say, that you're right about Carnap. I would say that Popper doesn't actually have this kind of view that you're talking about. In this sense, Popper is more of a liberal, but more of a liberal who doesn't quite know what the end point looks like at the end of the day. So in other words, I mean, this is why I think it's not surprising that Feyerabend, right, followed Popper, right? If you think about the people who tended to follow Popper, right? That in a sense, these were people who were, you know, in a very fundamental way, kind of anti-tradition, okay? And they actually weren't interested in establishing a new tradition. And this is the challenge to universities, I would say, right? Because there's a sense in which Carnap would be brilliant in starting a modern university, right? This is kind of where Carnap would really find his element, starting a modern university. We have a new foundation, it's a rational foundation, and then we really do the stuff that people ought to do. But not like the way they used to do it back in the Catholic Church when they ran the universities, right? That's kind of more Carnap speed. Popper is actually talking about something that's not so clear, okay? But what it's quite clear is he's against path dependency. And that's why Popper always, you know, when you know, the way this gets manifested in the Popperian discourse has to do with, well, look, if you're going to be so falsifiable about all scientific hypotheses and theories, right, isn't there just going to be a point in which you just falsify science altogether? Right? In other words, if you're going to be so self-critical, if you're going to be, you know, in other words, if you're not going to sort of trust what happens in the past, is this just going to be a point where you just don't, you don't believe in anything from the past is carrying forward? And Popper didn't really have a good answer to that, okay? That's the point, all right? The open society, in other words, doesn't have foundations in a sense that it would be set, you know, so the at the end of the day, it's faith, okay? It's faith with regard to Popper. Whereas Carnap actually thought, oh, there were these things that you could organize among like-minded people, and these would provide a more rational foundation than what you found elsewhere. That was more Carnap speed, and that was what logical positivism was about. And that's why logical positivism actually became the basis of analytic philosophy as a, quote, academic discipline in the United States in the second half of the 20th century, right? Because, in a sense, they had a sense of what they were about, and it was very clear, and they had boundaries and all this kind of stuff. Whereas Popper, he was kind of free-floating, right? He was this idea was being self-critical. So I don't think Popper actually answered the question that you're talking about sufficiently, but he was clearly against what Carnap was talking about. He was, in that sense, a very brute liberal, I would say. The only thing I would say against that, and so this is where I take it nobody here is a Popper scholar, because Popper scholars would have their own ways of finessing this, right, is that Popper himself is always worried about the issue of, well, look, the kind of things that you ought to believe and ought to promote should not harm people so much, right? So Popper, in a sense, the boundaries of his falsifiability had to do with what he called negative utilitarianism, right, the idea that whatever kind of science you were promoting and so forth, it couldn't harm people too much, right? So that was his bottom line kind of idea. But otherwise, I don't think Popper had any kind of really clear conception of a scientific community, right? This Polanyi kind of business, right, that you get around the same time. I don't think Popper had anything like that, actually. I think Popper was, in that respect, a very liberal thinker.
Right, this yeah. To your, what you want to ask about. So, you make Popper sound more revolutionary than I understood. And it seems to me that he would say, you know, we shouldn't be too bound by the past, but eventually we're going to get things right. Both in
I know.
Science out what kind of government and economy we want to have. And in that case, the past is a good thing. And
yes.
So then maybe we are just sort of constantly reasserting or maybe tweaking what we have a little bit.
No, he doesn't actually think that, right? I mean, this is where Popper's dispute with Kuhn in the Lakatos and Musgrave volume from 1970, if those of you who are familiar with all that kind of stuff, I don't know how familiar people would be, but Criticism and the Growth of Knowledge, which Lakatos and Musgrave edited then. Right, Popper's article in that view, in that book, which is basically this point where Kuhn gets invited out to London, right, to deal with all of the other people who are thinking about this kind of shit, right? So, you know, we got Toulmin and we got Feyerabend and we got Lakatos. We got all these people, and Popper, right? His article is called "Permanent Revolution in Science," right? Right. I mean, so the thing is that Popper, basically believes that Kuhn, who believes no revolution before its time, right? That's Kuhn's view, right? In other words, science has this path-dependent way, and it's only when it falls apart on its own terms that then you're licensed to have a revolution, right? Kuhn, right? So revolutions are these very limited kind of things. Popper's saying no, right? He's a Trotsky, right? Yeah, revolution, permanent revolution, right? This is his response, okay? And Feyerabend, I see this is where people like Feyerabend, I think, felt very empowered by somebody like Popper in a way in which they weren't by Kuhn. And here I think you would look at the correspondence between Kuhn and Feyerabend on this, right? Because when Kuhn puts out the first version of his manuscript on Structural Scientific Revolutions, Feyerabend's response is, man, what you're calling paradigms is ideologies, right? This is not what science is about. Okay, so this is, you know, so Popper, so the problem is, of course, the public persona of Popper is kind of a problem, right? The way he came across it, I mean, I remember seeing him at the very end of his career, and he did seem this kind of encrusted, you know, grievance-laden kind of guy, right? Nobody listens to me, nobody believes me, blah, blah, blah. And that doesn't look very progressive, okay? But that may be just a function of age, right? And Popper is someone who only becomes really well-known in the English-speaking world, right, after 1957 with the English translation of The Logic of Scientific Discovery. That's really when all this kind of stuff with relation to Kuhn starts to make any difference.
We have one more question.
Yes.
It's a kind of stuff that I was interested in his writing, so his application, his writing on biology, so moving away from physics as an exemplary science for philosophers of science, so his writing on philosophy of biology, on kind of philosophy of medicine, and so on and so forth. So let me frame my question in this way.
Well,
so they had quite a lot of continuities.
Yeah.
What are the ruptures that you can make?
Well, look, I mean, I think that in terms of the amount of time that we have actually at this point, I will just deal with the issue with regard to Popper, okay? Because I have a lot of sympathy for Popper, actually, as a guy who lived a long time. I would say that if you've got an idea that you want to promote, right, which I think Popper did, then the medium in which you promote it, the disciplines in which you promote the idea will change over time, right? So the fact that Popper starts off by talking about physics and then moves on to biology and so forth, I don't think one should necessarily interpret this as somehow Popper changing views or anything like this in any kind of fundamental way, but rather as a guy who thinks, look, you know, this is the way science should be, and the problem is the way science is institutionalized is a problem, because it separates all these disciplines, and these disciplines have these path-dependent tendencies, and guys like Thomas Kuhn are promoting this kind of idea, right? That's the problem, And so the issue then becomes, in what kinds of forums can I actually promote this general, what he regarded as a kind of emancipatory view of science that he was promoting? So in other words, liberalism is a kind of guiding idea, I would say, with somebody like Popper. But then there's a question, you know, for someone, I think it would be a very natural question for anyone who lives a long period of time, as to what exactly is the environment or the forum in which you actually promote this idea. And so biology, in a sense, may be more hospitable, you know, in the 1970s or whatever, than it, you know, and physics may be more hospitable in the 1930s, right? There's a sense in which the ideas, I think, maybe, you know, you might want to say the ideas remain constant. I don't think Popper really changed very much. This is why Popper, you know, those of you who know about Popper, right? This guy, you know, his big thing was about getting the logic of scientific discovery right, right? So he has all these multiple editions of it and appendices. I don't know if you know anything about Popper scholarship, right? This is kind of really what he was going after, right? To get it right about the nature of science. And then he would make all these kind of public pronouncements, you know, according to what was going on at the time, right? So there's this, and I didn't have time to talk about this, but I do think this is part of a certain understanding of liberalism that was around at the time. And I mentioned this in the abstract, and I'll just, obviously I can't talk about it here. But look, there are two ways of thinking about liberalism, right? One view starts from the assumption that society is very restrictive and what you have to do is loosen up things, right? That's one version of liberalism. And there's a certain sense in which the Enlightenment very much promoted this kind of idea, in the sense that people have natural reason, and if you just enable them to exercise it, they will do fine, right? That's one way. But the other way is to say, no, actually, the way the human condition operates is we have monopolies, we have concentrations, and what really we ought to be doing is breaking those down to enable people to be free. I would say Popper belongs to the latter category, and that's why falsifiability is such a big deal, okay? Because the idea is, if you let any human activity just naturally reproduce itself over time, it will in fact end up in this kind of path-dependent kind of way. And so what you need is actually external forcing of these tendencies to enable freedom to actually emerge for each successive generation. So when Thomas Jefferson said, right, that each generation needs to have a revolution, right, to be the blood of liberty, whatever he said, right? The idea that we shouldn't just assume that a constitution lasts forever once it's been established, but rather each generation has to, in some sense, ratify it. I think this is much more in the spirit of what Popper was getting at, and this is this aspect of liberalism: the idea that you need an intervention to enable and to continue liberalism, because the default position is not liberal, is where he belongs. And that's why he was very much against, I would say he was very much against Carnap, because Carnap looks like he's trying to establish an alternative foundation. Okay? Thank you.
Thanks a lot. I have a feeling that the discussion is not over yet.